Well, we have been reminded this week, with the anniversary of Gettysburg and the 4th of July, that the country's roots are soaked in blood. And now a gripping new summer read looks at the blood-soaked evolution of one state. The Sun, S-O-N, tells the story of Texas over 200 years through seven generations of the McCullough family. Eli, the patriarch, lives to see his family become cattle barons, then oil magnates. But his memories go back to the 1800s, when as a 13-year-old, his frontier family was attacked by Comanches.
It was said in the newspapers that mothers on the frontier saved their last bullets for their own children, so their children would not be taken by the heathens, but you did not hear of anyone actually doing it. In fact, it was the opposite. We all knew I was of prime age. The Indians would want me alive. My brother and sister might have been slightly old, but my sister was pretty, and my brother looked younger than he really was. My mother, on the other hand, was nearly 40. She knew exactly what they would do to her. The door flung open, and two men tackled her. A third man stood behind them in the doorway, squinting into the darkness of the house.
What follows is horrific. Eli kidnapped by the Comanches after watching his family be raped and killed. It's John Ford's The Searchers, but with excruciating detail. And then, decades later, Eli and his sons attack a Mexican neighbor with almost equal ferocity. The Sun is being called the new great American novel. And Philip Meyer joins us in the studio with more. Welcome, and what a read.
Thanks, Robin.
You know, I mentioned The Searchers. That film, which also had a brutal Indian attack and a kidnapping, it left a lot to the imagination. You don't. You go into detail of this torture. Why did you choose that?
I think it's quite important for us as Americans to understand the kind of legacy of violence that we come from. This is not to glorify it, and it's not to hold it up as something that we should continue. I think the frontier was basically a combat zone. This is something that even in a movie like The Searchers is seen as coming as a surprise to settlers. You know, the Native Americans ride out, you know, of the darkness and attack the good white family. This is the mythology that we grew up on. The fact is, all those families knew they were moving into the equivalent of, you know, sort of the worst neighborhood in the world. They were moving to a place in which they knew they were taking the land of other people, even if they didn't think of those other people as being fully human. They knew that they were moving to a place where they were going to maybe kill and maybe have to fight for their lives.
It's violence that keeps circling and circling. The Comanches are as vicious as they are because, as some of them explain to Eli when he is taken captive and becomes one of them, this torture was done to me and this was done to my family. And then he later reproduces it with his family against Mexicans. And it just keeps cycling.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Native Americans were fighting for their existence, tribe by tribe, band by band. As we moved west, they were driven further west or killed. And it's important to point out, this is not something that's unique to North America. This is something that, you know, is torture and this ritualized violence. You know, this is the Spanish Inquisition. This is much of World War I and II. This is Pol Pot in Cambodia. I mean, this is something that repeats itself throughout history.
And as you read today this book of history in Texas, you're thinking of Syria and Sunni Shia and Rwanda. I mean, it really goes right to there. But we mentioned Eli. We meet him in the 1800s. And then later in the book, he becomes this cantankerous elder patriarch. And we meet other people, his granddaughter, his son. What do each of those represent?
The book follows about seven generations of this one family, but we really focus on three characters. Eli is the first. The second is his son, Peter, who's in many ways the polar opposite. He has a very strict moral compass, which Eli does not. He's very passive. And the third character is Jean Ann McCullough, who's the great-granddaughter of Eli. And of all of these seven generations, she's the one who's most like him. She becomes the matriarch of the family. She saves the family from bankruptcy and kind of takes the family into the modern age and becomes a sort of oil baron.
Where did this story come from?
I was interested in exploring our American creation myths. On one hand, the sort of John Wayne idea that we, as Anglos, came to this unpopulated wilderness, and, you know, if we're poor, it didn't matter where we came from. You could move west, settle land, work hard, and make a new name for yourself. The competing mythology is sort of best summed up in, say, the movie Dances with Wolves. In the John Wayne mythology, it's the white folks who are good and the Indians who are bad. In the sort of Dances with Wolves mythology, the sort of counter mythology, it's the Indians or the Native Americans who are good and noble and basically peaceful, and the white folks that are bad. And the truth is, people are basically just people. One side certainly did lose. I mean, one side lost everything. But that's not to say that in terms of the when you apply sort of philosophical or moral calculus, they actually came out looking better.
Yeah. The New York Times references Kevin Costner in their glowing review of the book, and they say if he'd played Eli McCullough, he would have been shown going fully Native and learning a heartwarming life lesson about Aboriginal values that would have stayed with him during his dreary years back among his own race. But instead, he becomes, they don't say this, I do, that he becomes like a little creep, you know, who decides that all that matters is if I want something, I take it. The person I'm taking it from took it from someone else, and someone's going to take it from me someday. It's the Texas the McCulloughs make, or more accurately, steal, is one where theft is whitewashed into ownership.
Absolutely. And in some way, if we're honest, this is actually the history of the settlement of North America since Europeans arrived. There was not a single inch of North America that was unclaimed when we landed here. This is not to say that many of the Native American tribes were not doing the same thing to each other. I think when cultures and societies gain power, they tend to get acquisitive. When you look at the history of Texas, you have the Apache coming in. By 1650, they've wiped out almost all the other Native American tribes in Texas. 100 years later, the Comanche have come in and wiped out the Apache and done the same thing to them. And then the Anglos come in and take the land from the Comanche. Hopefully we've lost the violence.
Philip Meyer, speaking about his sweeping new novel set in Texas, The Sun. He's being praised for the accurate details of Indian and frontier life. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we want to ask about the research for the book.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now, and we're speaking with Philip Meyer. His new novel, The Sun, follows seven generations of Texans as they settle the frontier, fight, and live with Indians and Mexicans. There were the brutal bandit wars in the early 1900s, Mexican rebels vowing to wipe out the Anglos along the border, rustling cattle as they came and went. In Philip's novel, the McCullough family retaliates against peaceful Mexicans in response. The family eventually replaces cattle with oil fields. The book was born when Philip asked, why do oil barons swagger like cowboys? And he was pulled back into their past and literally pulled into it. Philip, talk about how you came to the details of Indian life and language. How do you know Indians use the F word?
The problem with looking at printed word and looking at literature as guidance for how people spoke in the old days are the obscenity laws, you know, that sort of went away in the 30s and in the 60s. We do know that the Comanche and people on the frontier and sailors made fairly vulgar jokes. The problem is you literally were not allowed to print those things until really the 1960s. So having Comanches and settlers curse was my best guess at the way people actually spoke in those days. In terms of getting to the skin of a character, I mean, this is something Eudora Welty famously said that, you know, your job actually is to physically inhabit a person, whether they're a saint or a mass murderer. Your job is to get inside their mind, to get inside their skin, and become that person. And that's what you do, you know, when you're writing.
Well, you did. Do I understand you got a crossbow? You went hunting?
I got a bow, yeah, a regular bow, and I killed a couple of deer with a bow and arrow and skinned them and ate all the meat and butchered them, and I went to a buffalo ranch and killed a few buffalo. These buffalo were headed for Whole Foods, essentially.
Wait a minute. Had you ever done this before? Was this a part of your trying to get into side these
no,
characters?
No, absolutely. I'd sort of done it a few times, but never with a seriousness. I'd never done it, not to this level. And I took classes on animal tracking, learned how to identify native plants, went around eating the sort of native plants of Texas, and learned how to start a fire with, you know, two sticks, basically, or three sticks, which was very, very hard. It took me a week. I did it once and then realized it would take me a year to master it.
What do you think it gave you?
It gave me the confidence to write about this stuff. I mean, I probably read 350 books, but
Wait, stop there. What were some of the books?
Well, Frederick Law Olmsted, for instance, has an amazing book. In 1855, he rides a horse across Texas with some friends. He published a very long book about this. This is before he designed Central Park.
And places here in Boston.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It gave me a sense of what the landscape looked like. Texas has dried up completely in about 100, 120 years as a result of intense cattle ranching and irrigation. Texas in 1850 was basically a short grass and tall grass prairie.
Yeah, so you had to know that in a scene where your Comanche were going from one place to another, you'd only see the upper half of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I slept outside and walked and hunted pretty much every place in Texas that the book takes place. And you know, if I saw a plant I didn't know, I would take a picture and look it up. You know, how is the light falling in this place? But after taking those notes, I then had to sort of figure out what is the time period that the characters are coming through here. Are we talking 1850? Because it'll look like this. 1900, it looks a different way. 1950, it looks much more like the way it looks now.
Yeah.
So the whole time I'm sort of taking these notes, I had to be very careful about applying the correct historical lens.
Quite something. And the language, what does the word Dauncey mean? It comes up
sad or crying. Yeah, so there's a book of 1850s slang, Bartlett's book of American slang, which is out of copyright now. So I got this, printed it out, and at night I would study about slang from that time period. And it says, oh, this is from the West, this is from St. Louis, this is from California. So those are all real words. I didn't actually invent them. But
I keep coming back to the detail about starvation or what it's like to be riding naked for hours when you're a captive. Oh, yes, you're going to be covered with sores. Or what it's like to be burned at the stake. Somebody spread out of the ground and fires were made by his hands and his feet, and slowly the fires were increased. Mm. I mean, just what somebody looks like when they're blown apart by a gun. You don't spare us. But I'm thinking you're living with that too. How did you live with that?
It was fairly unpleasant, and those were all taken from real life, and it certainly takes a mental toll. When I'm writing those kinds of scenes, I just have to be alone. I mean, I actually turn the lights off, or I'll sit under my desk and write. It's almost like being an actor, I think. You have to physically prepare yourself to write the part.
What are you hearing from people in Texas?
People seem to like the book. I had one lady who's from an old family. She came to a reading and she said, oh, you've gotten all the details right. We had a sort of brief disagreement about the context for what was called the Bandit Wars. This is the middle of the Mexican Revolution. Mexico is incredibly unstable. It's basically split into three parts. And that violence bled across the border quite a lot. And there was a good amount of cattle rustling going on. People would come across the river, take cattle, and head back south. And there were quite a high number of sort of targeted killings and random killings also on both sides. But the toll on Mexican-Americans was much higher, you know, by a factor of maybe 100. And this lady, who was quite sweet, said, you know, my great-grandfather was ambushed by Mexican bandits numerous times and was nearly killed, was in many gunfights. And so for her, the emotional truth of her family members being in grave danger was much more important than the sort of historical body count on both sides, which is quite lopsided. There were Anglos killed, but there were many, many more Mexican-Americans killed. Yeah. And this is something that Texans prefer to forget.
But she also said to you that, hey, you got it pretty much right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'd love as we leave? There's another section that maybe you could read for us. This is where Jean, who is the granddaughter of Eli who starts us off, he's captured by Indians and then returns to the white world.
Yeah.
And now Jean is an old woman. And she's reflecting on JFK's assassination. Would you read that for us?
Hmm. As for JFK, it had not surprised her. The year he died, there were still living Texans who'd seen their parents scalped by Indians. The land was thirsty, something primitive still in it. On the ranch, they had found points from both the Clovis and the Folsom, and while Jesus was walking to Calvary, the Mogollon people were bashing each other with stone axes. When the Spanish came, there were the Suma, Humano, Manso, La Junta, Concho, and Chisos, and Toboso, Ocana and Cacaxtal, the Qualtecans, Comacrudos, but whether they had wiped out the Mogollons or were descended from them, no one knew. They were all wiped out by the Apaches, who in turn were wiped out, in Texas anyway, by the Comanches, who were finally wiped out by the Americans. A man, a life, it was barely worth mentioning. The Visigoths had destroyed the Romans and had themselves been destroyed by the Muslims, who were destroyed by the Spanish and Portuguese. You did not need Hitler to see it was not a pleasant story. And yet, here she was, breathing, having these thoughts. The blood that ran through history would fill every river and ocean, but despite all the butchery, here you were.
Author Philip Meyer, reading from his new book, The Sun, a novel. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Cancer Center at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, providing care for a variety of cancers, including prostate, breast, skin, and blood cancers. BIDMC.org/cancercenter. And Diedrichs, with outdoor furniture, dinnerware, and home accessories, selected for form, function, and feeling for your home. DIDRIKS.com.